And there was a lot of discussion at the time about, are we breaking the all-volunteer force?
Now, some of these dynamics that brought the all-volunteer force into relevancy, it came into time in the 1970s labor economy, which is very different from what you see today.
If we did need to go to a total mobilization of the American population to serve against an existential threat, we'd have to have a real consideration and a real discussion about what actually are the standards for service.
What does it mean to maintain norms inside the profession? Yeah, that's critical.
Hey, welcome back to the MWI podcast, brought to you with the generous support of the West Point class of 1974. I'm John Amble, and for this episode, I had the chance to sit down with Jaron Wharton and Keith Carter. Jaron is an Army officer and a recent brigade commander, and Keith is a retired Army officer who now teaches at the Naval War College. During their careers, the Army sent both of them to earn their PhDs, and they found themselves on separate but intersecting academic paths that ultimately led them to really study the U.S. military's all-volunteer force model. In fact, they are two of the co-editors of a new book about the future of that model. How much have the strategic, economic, and social conditions that drove the decision to create an all-volunteer force changed over the past 50-plus years? How would it hold up in a modern, large-scale war? And if strategic realities required it, would a return to some form of conscription work? What would a modern draft really look like? This discussion tackles those questions and more, but before we get to it, as always, a couple quick notes. First, a very special thank you to the West Point class of 1974 for their generous support to MWI. And second, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, any other agency of the U.S. government, or those of any organization my guests are affiliated with. All right, here's my conversation with Jaron Wharton and Keith Carter. Jaron and Keith, thanks so much for joining me in this episode of the MWI podcast.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
Appreciate the opportunity, John.
So we're going to talk about, the all-volunteer force and the future of the all-volunteer force. I don't think we can talk about that without talking about its origins in the past. So we're going to touch on kind of all of that. You both are editors on a quite a new book project that I've seen sort of cross my desk in discussions about these things. So it's having an impact. It's having an influence. At least it's influencing discussions on what really is an important subject. Before we get into it, and maybe just to kind of give listeners a bit about your background and introduce the subject, I wonder, Jaron, if we can start with you, if you could kind of tell listeners a little bit about your background and what brought you to this book project.
Sure, thanks. I'm a career infantry officer, just recently commanded a brigade in the 82nd Airborne Division. But years ago, actually, Keith and I were in the same program, ASP3, and my doctoral research led me to really the war powers, which focused on 1973. And so kind of a deep-seated interest in that year, which was really a critical year for the military as an apparatus. And, as a couple years ago, when we started looking at kind of the 50th anniversary, I realized that a lot of the dynamics that we were experiencing at the time weren't necessarily centered around exclusively the transition to the all-volunteer force, but perhaps the convergence between several dynamics. It was also the 75th anniversary of desegregation, for example. It was the 50th anniversary of the War Powers Resolution, the transition to the total force policy, and the advent of the all-volunteer force. And while a lot of times people focus their research on, an inflection point as if it's an anniversary, as if it's an inflection point as its own, our thought was what we're experiencing required a wholesale interrogation of all these dynamics, the positive and the negative externalities, so that we can look forward to perhaps the 100th anniversary of the all-volunteer force.
And Keith?
Sure. So I was a career infantry officer. I served for 23 years in the infantry, primarily in light infantry units. And, in 2014, the Army, sent me to get a PhD, and I went to and got a PhD in political science. And I started really being interested in sort of how the composition of the force affects the use of force and what the force model for induction looks like and how that has political consequences, both for force employment and for force structure. Jaron and I have known each other for almost our entire military careers, going back all the way to like 2002 timeframe. And when he called me and told me about this project, I was really excited to get involved and told him I'd be willing to, help in any way that I could. And so I appreciate being brought onto the project and having an opportunity to think about these things.
The book is called Bend But Don't Break, right? It's about the future of the all-volunteer force. And as I mentioned at the outset, we can't really talk about the future without talking about the past. So just to kind of lay the foundation, 1973 comes and we transition, you know, after, you know, virtually every major war that the United States has fought has involved some form of conscription. Can we kind of, I guess, maybe sort of set the conditions for the discussion by talking about the dynamics that led to that decision in 1973 and the reasoning that leaders had for saying this is sort of the move that we think is necessary for the joint force?
Sure, I'd be happy to take that. And it's important to note that the decision wasn't made in 1973. It was actually several years prior. You know, use of the draft has been part of our country's history, really. And although not exclusively, it's occurred during wartime service. And it hasn't been without controversy. And obviously, Vietnam was no different. But what made it a little bit different is that the perception of service was not believed to be universal in that war. And that became really problematic, especially the inequity that surrounded it. Now, in a draft, you know, although it is controversial, manpower issues are relatively straightforward. They're not really hard to solve because you're just bringing people in. But in some cases, it was how service was avoided, you know, the societal tax, if you would, that was placed on people who did serve. And that became really the impetus for change and foundational to the argument. And Nixon made this part of a campaign pledge to shift the Army to a volunteer based. Now, that wasn't without controversy. And candidly, Nixon, almost 10 years later, thought maybe this was a failed experiment altogether. Now, while hard to imagine now, there's much debate as to whether this could be done at all. Could we raise a military of sufficient size? What would the cost be? And that's beyond just the monetary costs. Could a conflict be fought with volunteers? And was that even desired? In fact, there's a particular exchange that's been pretty prominent between, you know, like eventual Nobel laureate Milton Friedman, where it's insinuated that, you know, could this, were we just raising an army of, or a military rather, of mercenaries? Of which, in a kind of a pithy way, he replied that, well, it's better than the servitude of the conscription-based system. Now, some of these dynamics that brought the all-volunteer force into relevancy, it came into time in the 1970s labor economy, which is very different from what you see today.
Right.
You had perhaps a higher propensity to serve. You had the baby boom generation that led to a larger body of qualified men. There's a lot more familiarity with uniformed service. And then frankly, that 1970s economy offered lower prospects for upward mobility, which is an important thing. And so you started to see some space for a volunteer-based service to actually be a relevant alternative.
And, you know, you mentioned, it was interesting that you mentioned, you know, it's an open question whether or not we could do that now. However, in the last 53 years, you know, at some point the status quo becomes normal. And right now it's very difficult to imagine, especially for those of us who serve or have served, it's hard to imagine something other than the all-volunteer force. Has that been, you know, at what point did that become kind of the norm and the expectation among service members that this is the type of force that they serve in? And were there times in the last 53 years where that was questioned? You know, you mentioned Nixon having some doubts 10 years after, but, you know, during moments of crisis, during the Cold War, during the Gulf War, were there moments when people said, hang on a second, maybe this doesn't work anymore?
So I think that's a really interesting and important question. You know, when I talk to my students at the Naval War College, I mean, many of them, you know, I ask the question, can you think about what would happen if we went back to a draft? And I think what I've learned from them is that there's sort of this implicit assumption that if we needed the draft, it would still be there. Now, some scholars are starting to raise the question if that's true. But I think in the background of everybody's mind, there's this operating concept that, like, if we went to a big enough war, we're going to have to resume the draft. We've got the process in place to do that. We've got the national mobilization through the selective service. That's always been sort of the fail-safe. But the question is could we really institute that? And what would it look like? And how much resistance would it engender among the population once you're forced to serve? And I think that there's some really, you know, interesting questions that are raised from that. But I also think it's important to remember that, you know, this draft versus conscript, we're framing it as a very binary thing, but there is a continuum of volunteerism that is, you know, sort of present in the force, right? Because, you know, on the one hand, during the, you know, height of the global war on terror, during the, you know, 2007 to 2012 timeframe, we were stop-lossing soldiers, which prevents them from exiting the force, even though they've served the initial terms of their contract because we needed them for the war. You know, so at that point, did they move from being a pure volunteer to being some form of a conscript? It's an interesting question to ask. And there was a lot of discussion at the time about, are we breaking the all-volunteer force? Are we breaking the army? I mean, I don't know what Jaron's number is, but I'm sure it's high. But I did 8 tours to Iraq and Afghanistan, 5 to Afghanistan, 3 to Iraq. And so, you know, by not having this draft, we really concentrated the service into the few people that, you know, decided to stay the course and continue to serve throughout the course of their career.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's an interesting point about the other forms of compulsory service that actually occurred during the GWAT that are often not discussed. You know, you mentioned one, which was the advent of stop loss, but you can also look at extended deployments from 12 to 15 months as well. Something one of our colleagues, Kate Kosminski, mentioned recently. Yeah, but in terms of an alternative, you know, it's interesting if, you know, when we first started talking, or when it was first discussed to move to an all-volunteer force, again, like I mentioned before, it wasn't really believed, certainly with uniformed service members, that might work, certainly might work well. And now the mention of moving to the alternative is almost alien, certainly not amongst, you know, uniformed service members, but really with the general public. You know, because it's the AVF has become elemental to the success of the joint force. It has shouldered a significant load. It's hard to imagine. Certainly the Gates Commission, which is largely responsible for the current construct, could not have imagined some of the widespread success, certainly at the tactical and operational level, of the all-volunteer force. It's been the military has been fundamentally reshaped into a skilled cadre that is high morale. It's well compensated, and it's certainly a more integrating factor for all the joint services.
That's a really good point. You know, specifically the mention of high morale, because, you know, I'm curious how being an all volunteer force, how sort of integral that is to the military, the joint forces culture, and the service cultures today. As you said, you know, as the character of warfare is changing, it's becoming, you know, it requires more highly skilled, high aptitude personnel who volunteer for service. And so now you have that element on top of the fact that, hey, I stood up and raised my right hand and said, I'll do this.
Yeah. So I think I think a lot of people assume, and there's plenty of reason to suspect, that because people are volunteered, they're more motivated once they get in the service. They're, you know, we're hiring and, you know, nurturing a better quality base recruit. And I think that there's probably some evidence on that, but I think, like, you can look to the quality of and the capability of, like, the Ukraine army right now, who has been waging a very protracted defensive effort in a high tech, you know, sort of spy versus spy sort of dynamic tit for tat with the evolution of drone warfare. And they've proven to be very capable in spite of the fact that they are predominantly a conscription-based military. So I think that is limited evidence that, you know, we could get very high recruits. And I think, you know, one of the things that a draft sort of requires to be successful is you have to have a common appreciation that the reason the government has decided to use force is necessary and legitimate. And I think that's one of the biggest, you know, possible impediments to reestablishing a draft in our current environment with the era of political polarization. I'm just not sure you'll ever convince uniformly the American public that there's a legitimate reason for the use of military force, which implies that if we had to go back to a draft, some people would view the use of military force as illegitimate. And if they got drafted, would probably be upset and potentially protest the war or dodge the draft or engage in some of these other activities.
Yeah. And if I can add on that, I mean, a lot of people kind of pose this question is in terms of, should we return to the draft or return to conscription or not? like Keith mentioned earlier, this is not a binary construct. In fact, when the Gates Commission ratified their recommendations, they most definitely talked about the need to have this all-volunteer force supported by an effective standby draft. Now, the belief is that it would be done in a way that departed from the experience of Vietnam. And that was very much a necessity. But, you know, it's interesting because in the global war on terrorism, that was largely completely shouldered by the all-volunteer force. In ways, again, that was not believed to be how it would be mobilized in the later portion of the 1960s and the early portion of the 1970s. Its ability to adequately source or fight the global war on terrorism required a shift in the reserve component that is quite notable. Yeah. You started to see this, what was supposed to be a strategic reserve, become more of an operational reserve that could be used almost interchangeably with the active component. Not designed years ago. But oftentimes we think that the draft is gone. That's not true. The draft never went away. And although we might consider it as unimaginable today, it's really just on ice. It's a muscle that we can't afford to let atrophy.
Yeah, I mean, we all remember, right, when you turn 18, registering for the Selective Service. And it's a good point because we think, oh, we have an all-volunteer force. And that's, you know, sort of the binary opposite of a conscription-based army, but it was always backstopped by this alternative that was there, you know, sort of break glass in case of emergency. I think the fact that we didn't see that at the height of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan shows that it's not so easy necessarily to break that glass, even if you have been requiring 18-year-olds to register for the Selective Services, you know, when they come of age. Keith, you mentioned something interesting about, you know, it sort of works when there's a sense of unanimity about the reason why we're doing this. And if you think about countries where the draft exists or universal conscription exists, often I think, you know, I'm stepping out of my areas of expertise, so please, you know, correct me if I'm wildly wrong about this. But the countries where it seems like it serves its purpose are places where even when there's political differences, and there certainly are in virtually every country, virtually every democracy, there's at least a sort of a somewhat common understanding of the threat landscape. Places like South Korea, where right across the border, right across the DMZ, there's North Korea. Places like Israel, where certainly what we've seen now is there's a huge political divide in terms of, you know, the sort of security policy approach that Israel should be taking. But there's a general consensus that there are real threats in their neighborhood. I wonder if, you know, if that naturally just makes it challenging in a country like the United States that has sort of global interests, you know, global potential for involvement, a global military footprint. We've got people at any point in time in, you know, well over 100 countries in the world. If that, you know, in your opinion, if that makes it more challenging.
No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, you know, countries that are facing some sort of existential threat to their way of life or their existence have a commonality of purpose, and there's a definite legitimacy to a war of defense of your state. And the question is, you know, to what degree does America's military actions meet that criteria? And most of what the military does is sort of maintain the global commons, defend the institution, you know, the Western liberal order, which is, you know, falling in and out of fashion. And I think there's a lot of people that are questioning the expense and the cost and all these other things for doing this sort of, you know, again, freedom of the seas, freedom of commerce. You know, forward occupying, forward footprints, commitments to allies. And these things, I think, you know, do not enjoy the same sort of unified purpose as, you know, defense of the homeland would. And the question is, you know, in today's age, can we ever really see a credible threat to the homeland that would sort of engender a wide call to service and reduce the barriers for reenacting a draft?
I wonder if I was recently working on an article that we published at MWI, and just seeing some of the statistics about, you know, it's sort of become a platitude that military service in the United States has become a family business, right? Your propensity to serve is extraordinarily higher if you've got a family member that served. A huge number of recruits have a parent that served. They grew up in and around military bases. The geographic footprint of where the recruits are coming from tends to look very different now than it did a generation ago. In, you know, when the all-volunteer force was introduced, you know, and speaking of the reserve components, right, this was an effort to sort of embed the military in society to some degree so that when the decision was taken to go to war, particularly to mobilize what was, as you said at the time, meant to be a strategic reserve, people were going to feel it. Communities were going to feel it. To what extent, you know, I guess, are there mechanisms that can be, you know, that can be used to sort of roll back some of that condensing of the recruitment base and encouraging a wider, more diverse geographically, you know, socioeconomically, sort of body of people to consider serving in the military?
So I actually think that's the great question that puts the all-volunteer force on a sustainable path, if not from a fiscal standpoint, certainly from just a manpower standpoint. It's this connection that seems to be lost. I'll give you two quick anecdotes, one that drove the book and one that was personal to me. One, this book project had actually started. I had started taking my kids around the country to every Major League Baseball stadium. For a personal reason, my son had a bad Little League coach, and I said, get in the car, like, let's go. And we started going to all these stadiums, which was coincidentally a great way to see the country. But outside, while we're waiting in line, to get in, we started to have a lot of fantastic conversations, you know, because I kind of look military, you can't tell on a podcast. But I was amazed at how people wanted to engage me once they, you know, found out that I was in the military. They'd asked me some pretty provocative things that cut against partisan lines. So this whole trip certainly was not intended to be a prelude to scientific inquiry, but became one. You know, and then, you know, when we fast forward into like the seventh inning stretch, most ballparks or pick a public event across the country has some sort of like veteran of the game. And in baseball, it's usually around the seventh inning stretch, somewhere there, they stand in almost blind deference to someone whose career more times than not is actually not that remarkable by scrutinous onlookers. And so there's this cognitive dissonance between the conversations at the beginning of the game and towards the end of the game. Then when it came back, that's, you know, Keith was my first call, frankly. And then the other day we were doing an event and, you know, I told a story about, you know, my sister, social worker, another very dedicated public servant. And I said, you know, look, my sister, apart from the fact that I've been deployed a lot, my wife has been deployed a lot, other families have been deployed a lot, you know, you can lament that it bothered you that I was deployed, but it didn't actually physically tax you in any way, shape, or form. So when we talked about the convergence between the War Powers Resolution, for example, the total force policy, and the advent of the all-volunteer force, there's an interactive effect amongst those things. It's not just how do we change our force composition. It's also who goes and what is the mechanism for which we use it. And if that doesn't impact the entire, you know, American population, for instance, through a taxation or through some sort of compulsory service in some way, shape, or form, then you're going to continue to have an isolated group, warrior caste, or what have you. And that's problematic and fundamentally threatens the AVF.
Yeah, so I have some great anecdotal evidence as well. So, you know, we're an Army family. My wife and I both served, and my oldest son is getting ready to head off to Army Advance Camp next week in pursuit of an ROTC commission at the end of his senior year. My youngest son is starting his ROTC application. Both my sons will be fourth generation Army. And I think that the consolidation into families is, you know, on first glance, it appears to be kind of shocking. But the reality is my kids know exactly what to expect. They have complete familiarity with service. They know what it looks like day in and day out. It's not mysterious to them. They understand what it means to go to the field, what it means to be gone for a month, what it means to move every couple of years. And so it's a lifestyle that's familiar to them. But I will say that I think this engagement piece is critical, because when I was at my graduate program in the greater Philadelphia area, I was active in the Boy Scout troop there on, you know, with my sons. But two of the scouts in that troop, because of their familiarity with me and how I would talk about my service, have since joined the Army. And in both cases, their parents called me first and I said, don't let your son go to the recruiter until I've called the recruiter. And on both cases, I called the recruiter, said, hey, I got this guy coming in. I know their family. I know them. They're, you know, Eagle Scouts and they're, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And they've both joined the Army. Ryan Check has actually, you know, finished his first tour of duty up in Alaska. And Michael Fulmer has reported to Hawaii, just finished basic training a couple months ago. And that's just the, you know, two guys that I was, you know, instrumental in their joining the Army. It's questionable whether they ever would have even thought about it. Sure. Had they not just had a chance encounter with me, because, you know, just like Jaron was talking about, when I got into that greater Philadelphia sort of community, I was the only person around that had, you know, been to the war, had served in the Army. And so it's an interesting anecdotal sort of story.
I don't think it's questionable whether or not they would have joined. From my experience in talking to people, it's become almost a necessary precondition for, you know, to have that sort of propensity to serve, is to have that at least some window into what it actually looks like and, you know, the opportunities that it affords, the costs that it entails. So you can make that decision, because it's just not really considered among the alternatives for the vast majority of people. And it, there's just a question of how sustainable that is, particularly if we get into a war where there's going to be much higher manpower requirements, where stop lossing and extended deployments isn't going to be enough.
Yeah, I think that's right, John. And a lot of times we get into this conversation about eligibility and propensity. Look, a lot of people had a more familiarity with the military based off the legacy of previous generations when you did have mass mobilization. As you start to see people kind of entrench into large military bases in kind of rural America, it shouldn't surprise anyone that we become more isolated, or that we become kind of caricatures and pick your media, which has changed over years, right? Which is candidly a chapter. I think if we were to turn this back, we would probably add a chapter on that in terms of the military, how it's represented in pop culture. But look, eligibility is diminishing. It's somewhere typically in the 70 percentile range. Propensity, it's about 1 in 10. On any given day. And a lot of people that join actually weren't initially propended to serve, but it's about, like he said, overall awareness and familiarity. But on the eligibility side, look, that's a societal issue that impacts the military, not the other way around.
So what can be done? You know, if we imagine a future large scale sustained conflict that is going to impose manpower demands that the AVF is just not able to, you know, there's only so much that signing bonuses and retention bonuses can do. You know, I guess how does that transition, if it's determined that some form of draft is required again, what does that look like?
Well, first, that's an inherently political decision that requires, as my colleague Kate Kosminski said the other day, like, an enormous mobilization of the political will, my words, not hers, of both the president and the Congress.
Yeah.
Has to. They would have to go all in. And, you know, if that situation is required, then we better well make sure that machinery actually works. In many respects, you know, it's really an interesting question. You know, if you were to ask, you know, senior military leaders over time and perhaps senior civilian leaders over time, at what point is that threshold where you think that triggers a draft? At what amount of loss of life is that? Is that a battalion, a brigade, a division? It's certainly an interesting thought experiment to kind of drive. But if you do need to go that way, again, it's always standby, which is often lost. You've got to make sure that machinery works.
Yeah. And I think, the other thing is there's going to be a lot of levers that get pulled before a draft gets enacted, right? Because, as Jaron indicated, it's going to take a massive amount of political will, and there's going to have to be a perceived legitimacy for this to even be, a starter. And before the draft gets called, obviously we'll have full mobilization of the reserves and the National Guard. We'll have a recall of everybody that's continuing to remain on the inactive ready reserve roster. We'll have some degree of activation for the retired reserve. Yeah. Remember that all retirees are subject to recall until age 65. And once all of that would be expended, we would start having a conversation about whether or not it was time to restart the draft. And, you know, one of the things that I really appreciate about Kate Kosminski's work is that she's shown that the draft is not an immediate solution, right? It's going to take, what's her analysis, Jaren, a year from the decision to full mobilization of the first wave of recruits?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's D plus 191 for the first recruit to enter the MEP station.
Yeah.
Approximately.
Yeah, so you're already 6 months in, right, before you even started in processing people. So, you know, I think the reality is that if you're going to need a draft, you have to go early. The political reality is you're going to want to delay that decision for as long as possible, which sets up a lot of tension for how we think about mobilizing the total economy and the total population for a war that would require it. Difficult.
Is that a, you mentioned the, Jaren, you mentioned the thought experiment about what level of loss is going to be enough to sort of trigger that, you know, a societal will, political will to be able to do this. Is that a thought experiment that you guys internally and your co-editors and the authors that contributed to the volume have had? I mean, have you given any thought to that? Because it's, you know, we talk about sort of inflection points in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan as, you know, talking about casualties numbered in the single digits or low double digits, something, you know, I guess orders of magnitude larger than that could trigger some change, but would it be enough? You know, would a battalion of casualties be enough to affect society? Would a brigade?
Yeah. So we've talked about it. It obviously wasn't part of the book. I mean, look, part of the reason why the book is designed the way it is, I'll kind of answer this in two parts, is to close that familiarity gap. I mean, you won't find a p-value in the book. It's less than 300 pages to get out of kind of academic stovepipes, and it's accessible to the general public by design because we wanted to close it. So we had to make some tough decisions on time in terms of what we left on the cutting room floor. I mentioned earlier kind of the military and pop culture was one of the things, and then what it would take to trigger the draft. You know, we all don't agree on these things either, which is really, really healthy. And I think underlines the tension, you know, because we had a couple editor or a couple authors that were sought, you know, actually argued for in some way, shape, or form a return to conscription. At least some pointed out a lot of the highlights of the positive externalities associated with the draft. Now, can I put a convenient number on it? I can't, because it's one of those things. It's like certain rules and conditions apply. You know, my thought personally is that if there's an existential threat to the country, that we would mobilize greatly. I think we've already seen in history that's not necessarily the case. In fact, we've had people advocate to return to work, and you can debate the merits of that. But as in terms of a particular number, I can't put a finger on it. But we have debated it, but not to any degree of success.
And the challenge there is then defining, you know, what is an existential threat, because that's also, you know, it's not an easy thing to do.
Exactly. And, you know, I think, you know, the easiest case is that there's an identifiable attack against the United States. And in those, you know, in the easiest case, this is really going to happen. It's going to be fine. But I think we have to remember that, you know, with the advent of the information domain of warfare and our adversaries actively seeking to influence American opinion, through social media and other information, activities, there's going to be a lot of counter information that is going to create people that have opinions that it's not an existential threat. And I think that, you know, our adversaries would be very wise to consider keeping things at the low grade state to not rise above that threshold demonstrably until they're fully ready. But I think one of the other, you know, elements of this conversation is that if we did need to go to a total mobilization of the American population to serve against an existential threat, we'd have to have a real consideration and a real discussion about what actually are the standards for service. Because right now, part of, you know, we're talking about propensity to serve, medical readiness, medical qualifications. But the reality is when you're looking at mobilizing the population, you know, are you going to need the same standards for service that you have in an all-volunteer force when you're drafting people to be admin clerks and potentially never deployed downrange, to be x-ray technicians, to be dental hygienists? I mean, there's a lot of jobs in the military that do not necessarily require the highest degree of physical readiness. And if we're all pitching in together to defeat an existential threat, I think we're going to see a very quick renorming of those standards so that people can go to the jobs that they're suited for and contribute to the war effort.
Yeah, we had John Spencer, who studies urban warfare with the Modern War Institute now, but used to be on staff while he was a serving Army officer. And he had these little green Army men sitting on his desk. And he loved to, when cadets would come in, ask them, you know, is this what service, military service looks like to you? Do you have to have this sort of physique? And do you have to, you know, be carrying a rifle? Because if you're a cyber warrior right now, most of your days aren't spent carrying a rifle. Most of your days aren't spent out in the field. You're doing other things. And so the requirements of service as the character of warfare is changing, I think opens that door. And yet we still have these biases, right? That we still have these biases of what military bearing looks like. And it does involve physical fitness, and it does involve certain traits that maybe are becoming increasingly or decreasingly common within the general population. Speaking of those biases, you know, I came to the Army through officer candidate school. So I went to basic training. While I was in basic training, our drill sergeants asked, you know, the group, why did you choose to be here? And I responded and said, because I wanted to wear a uniform with this flag on the sleeve. I was young, naive, you know, pretty simple-minded about service at the time, but that hasn't gone away. I still think that way about service. And more importantly, I like the idea of serving around other people that felt that way. And so I think for most people in the Army, across the Joint Force and all the armed services have probably an inherent bias in favor of the all-volunteer force. Now that we are, you know, there's not a single person serving on active duty right now that served prior to 1972, prior to that transition. And so as we see often with leaders that come up within a certain system, they tend to want to preserve that system in which they succeeded. How much institutional pushback, you know, would the political class, political leaders get from the military if there was a movement toward reinstituting some form of conscription?
Well, I'll make 2 points. One, on the motivation for serving, I've served in a small subsect of the broader military, right? It took me about 20 years to realize, I think, people actually join for one of two reasons, that they're either running to something or they're running from something. and so I came to that realization about a couple years ago. And I think it's, you know, people's motivations to serve can happen for a variety of reasons. In terms of, you know, would there be a significant pushback? I mean, it's hard to tell. It's, again, one of those certain conditions. You know, our current military construct is shaped out of a legacy of Vietnam, like almost everything about it. Yeah. If you recall the Weinberger-Powell Doctrine, it set across a couple, you know, standards for the application of force. I would find it very hard to believe that you would find, like, even if you bring up to a former senior leader who grew up even as a lieutenant in the early 70s, like, it's inconceivable for them to consider going back to a conscript-based army, because it is so far removed from the professional nature of what we have before. Yeah. It would be very hard for me to believe that anyone would want to go back there. That being said, it doesn't mean that the costs of the AVF aren't worth further interrogation. And again, that was part of the impetus for the book. So that might drive some change on the margins. And frankly, that's where we kind of fell out as a group of co-editors with our text, and that it would require just to be sustained some changes on the margins, because it's not the same 1970s labor economy. It's not the same demographics in the United States. And certain things have changed demonstrably over time that, you know, the Gates Commission didn't foresee.
Yeah, I think it's, I think having a highly capable, highly skilled, credible all-volunteer force has been a real game changer for the day-to-day activity for those that have served in leadership positions. And, a lot of the terminology that you hear employed, like, you know, I'll take you to the wood line, wall-to-wall counseling, that all, exists because back in the day, NCOs had to exert coercive, often physically coercive, control over their soldiers who were trying to shirk from their duties because they didn't want to be there in the first place. And I think it's really interesting to think about what it looks like day to day on a heavy training op tempo where you're requiring people to all have, a commonality of purpose and want to do their best What happens under circumstances where that's not uniformly the case? What's that look like day to day for the non-commissioned officers and the officers that have to lead those formations? How does it really impact effectiveness, readiness, motivation? Anybody that's served for any period of time in a leadership role knows that you spend 90% of your time dealing with 10% of your formation. Mm-hmm. Well, now imagine if 25% of your formation was, not motivated, didn't want to be there, having disciplinary problems. That's a day-to-day challenge that's going to quickly overwhelm the Army's, UCMJ processing and all that stuff. And if you can just misbehave and get thrown out of the Army, what does that mean for a draft and a conscripted force? Because obviously, you just fulfill the requirements, induct yourself through the draft, and then do something that gets you kicked out of the service, and now you're good to go. You don't have to be there anymore.
It's interesting. We kind of reinforce kind of alternative mindset in some pretty important ways. I was talking to Keith the other day about this. We go to a combat training center, for example, and we're always told, for example, to work your replacement mechanisms, and that's important. As if there's a standing body of replacements that are always ready and on the call to be there, which is not necessarily the case. Again, D plus however many days to get the first recruit into the MEP station. And there's this almost baked in assumption that they're going to integrate well in mass. In a training center, we get the same guys back, 48 to 72 hours later. That's not the case. That's certainly not the case. And it's a much different dynamic that, again, is very it's hard for us to conceive in what happens when you decimate a company or a battalion. What does that look like? We're thankful that we haven't experienced that in the present day, not to the extent certainly that mass warfare that we're seeing in other parts of the world right now or that we've experienced in the past. But that doesn't mean that it can't return, which is the great contingency here. What is that decision point that causes political leaders to shift their mindset to mobilize the entire population in support of an existential crisis?
So that's been the sort of implicit forcing function that we've used as a framework to discuss a return to conscription, right? Major war and a need for manpower. What about the peacetime arguments about national service, military service principally, for closing the civ-mil divide by bringing a more diverse recruiting base into the military and sort of both reshaping the military's identity, but also society's and its connection to the military?
So I think, this is an argument that my father makes, right? Like we've got to go back to some form of national service because, people have lost their, commonality with their fellow citizens and civic education's at an all-time low. And essentially, I think my quippy answer would be, hey, it's not the military's job to fix those problems. The military's job is to fight and win the nation's wars. And people are trying to use a draft to fix other problems that need to be fixed through other ways, right? The military does not exist to instill a civic virtue, civic pride, commonality of citizenship. That's a tangential and secondary benefit of service, but we shouldn't raise it to the first principle of service by saying, hey, we've got to have a draft so we can fix these things. We should look to, probably fix that through our common core education in the primary school system and other outlets. That would be my initial response.
Yeah, and I can't disagree with that. I mean, there's been calls that I think will always fall flat, unfortunately, for national level public service. I say, unfortunately, kind of half-hearted. I like the Constitution, like all parts of the Constitution. Individual liberties are what individual liberties are, and so I want people to be able to choose to serve or not to serve. And I think most people can agree on that. That doesn't mean that we can't change the incentive structure to get people to serve. And it's an important point here, and I'll make two actually. One is the military does not have a monopoly on public service altogether. And so I'm not sure that it's healthy to just kind of act in a way that is the case. Frankly, going back to the baseball metaphor, I would like to see a teacher as kind of the hero of the game, for example, because there are certainly other ways to serve, and we need to continue to incentivize that. And by doing so, whether it's in civics education or maybe it's for college applications, maybe it's, you know, how we used to do like the presidential physical fitness badge. I know there's a modern evolution of that, but how can we get this into our classrooms and bridge that familiarity gap that we know exists? You know, Rosa Brooks once quipped that there's a paradox between enthusiasm for the military coupled with an ignorance about it.
Yeah.
And we've got to solve that. At a bare minimum, we have to educate people on the real costs of the force. And it's a continuum too. You know, sometimes where you stand is, it depends on where you sit. And when someone comes in, the all volunteer force is extremely expensive. And rightly so. You have to compete in a private, in the current labor dynamic. But also, as those veterans transition into when they take off their uniform, their costs basically go from discretionary spending to mandatory spending, which is also quite costly. And in the GWAT alone, we threaten to overwhelm the absorptive capacity of the VA. And that's before you start getting the debates in terms of how we use military force. And that's over time. And so when we looked at this kind of holistically, and we thought it was important to look at 100 years, our dependent variable is 100 years. Because when you start talking into like, how do you tinker in this item or this item, it's very easy to get people pulled into their partisan fiefdoms. And we have got to elevate discourse beyond that, lest we alienate people further.
Your book describes the all-volunteer forces at an inflection point. I guess, how long is this a momentary inflection point? We have an opportunity right now to try to fix this, or a responsibility to try to fix this, or is this just sort of a problem that's only going to continue to be exacerbated as long as it's ignored and that there aren't remedies sort of at least identified and put in place?
Well, look, I think that there are real-time consequences to not promoting a dialogue on the health of the all-volunteer force. I do. Is it going away? I don't see that anytime in the near future, absent an existential crisis. But there are things that we can be doing right now that are not just internal to the service, but external to the service. I think we've got to really promote a dialogue on what those are. For example, in our book, Mike Meese, General Meese, talks about what should we owe our veterans. It is nearly impossible to have that conversation because it's like the third rail of politics. How dare you consider taking anything away from our veterans? It would be the death knell for a politician. But with rising healthcare costs, rising disability ratings, it's probably a conversation worth having. And a lot of times when we start talking about, you know, whether or not this is healthy, it becomes this binary construct of to have the draft or not have the draft, and we've got to elevate the discourse there.
So one of the things that I've found in talking about this is that there are a lot of people who implicitly understand that it's important, but don't necessarily care all that much about it because they're attracted by the shiny objects of drones and electronic warfare and, you know, all sorts of different, you know, more tangible, sexier subjects that are going to define our success in the next war. But I had a conversation. I had a chance to record a podcast. This is several years ago now, not long after Army Futures Command was stood up with the commander of Army Futures Command. And I started the conversation by asking about a lot of hardware and tech and software and things like that. And he said, look, we have the .mil PFP spectrum for a reason, and we're looking comprehensively at all of it. And our success on the future battlefield is going to be determined just as much by, you know, decisions like whether or not we adopt a regimental system that keeps soldiers together in units longer rather than moving them every 2 to 3 years, whether or not we get our recruitment sort of policies right, whether or not we have the right training infrastructure, a whole host of subjects. How have you found the response since the book was published and you've been having these conversations? Have you noted any of that, what I alluded to or what I said, you know, at the outset of this question, which is that people understand that it's important, but it's not really like the sexy subject that they want to get deep into the weeds on?
Yeah, I think it's really instrumental in the way that we frame these questions. Much of the the day-to-day discussion is about technological procurement and how technologies are changing the character of war. But, you know, I think, again, Ukraine serves as a useful data point where, you know, very technologically sophisticated war, rapid innovation, tit-for-tat exchange with the Russian that forces continual adaption, particularly in the drone environment. But the casualties from that war on both sides are numbering in the hundreds of thousands, right? So even, you know, so on the other hand, you know, the technology argument, turning it sort of on its head, is to say that, hey, war is becoming more lethal. That's going to increase the sort of manpower demands. It might necessitate a return to the draft even earlier than it did. I mean, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were long, but they weren't particularly lethal. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But I mean, imagine fighting today in Iraq or Afghanistan with drones, some of which are commercial off the shelf and capable of carrying a payload. You can buy a drone on Amazon today that can carry 6 pounds, which is plenty for a hand grenade, a Molotov cocktail, a small, you know, sort of artillery munition. And we're living in giant plywood shacks that are all, you know, flammable. Right. And so even if you look at how we chose to operate in the most recent American combat experience, if you update that for the drones that are available to anybody today, it would be a much more lethal engagement. It probably wouldn't rise to the levels of what we're seeing in Ukraine, but it would certainly rise compared to the historical levels that we have. And so I think that this technology is increasing lethality, which may perversely put a higher demand for a return to the draft because we're going to have more losses.
Yeah, look, I mean, to Key's point, I mean, a lot of people want to talk tech today, and there's nothing wrong with that. I think that actually highlights the need for scholarship like we've put forward. You know, going through a doctoral program, it became readily evident to me, for example, that we tend to operate in these silos, right? You know, civ-mil scholars tend to operate in civ-mil scholars' literature. People look at decisions to use military force, like myself, sent kind of stovepiped in that peer-reviewed literature, which is not accessible, right? Yeah. Veterans policy folks tend to have more veterans policy papers that aren't in the peer-reviewed category, but no one really looks at a holistic appraisal of all these issues. And there's an opportunity cost to not doing so. And so, you know, I've kind of experienced since the book came out, but there's one thing to publish something, and then there's another thing entirely, and that's to continue to promote the conversation. And that is absolutely paramount here. And that's not just outside the profession, but it's inside the profession. Like, what does it mean to maintain norms inside the profession? Yeah, that's critical. That's critical. And you start to see those conversations. We've seen those conversations. You know, a lot of times I'll give an example, and I don't think anyone has ever put this well as my colleague Heidi Urban did, but she talked about, you know, the three P's, if you would. And I think, you know, these are paramount to the success moving forward of the all-volunteer force, and they're certainly relevant today as tech, if not more so. And that's, you know, political, partisan, and politicized. You know, a lot of people say, you know, the military is apolitical. That's fundamentally not true. It is a political entity. It has a budget. It lobbies. It participates in the policymaking process. What it can't become is partisan.
Yeah.
And it certainly can't become, and that's statute, and it certainly can't allow itself to be politicized by anyone at any time or any place. And that's, you know, there's a large role to be played there by people inside and outside the military over time. I mean, these aren't things that are specific to any sort of party or platform. They're enduring challenges. And when you don't address them, then you're going to push people into their fiefdoms and inherently alienate folks. And what you really need to do is, although this is inherently a political comment to make, is grow your base. So you're not recruiting from the same traditional hotspots. That is the true secret sauce to the vitality of the AVF.
Well, the roster of contributors of the book is fantastic. I mean, anybody who, you know, reads even a little bit on the subject will recognize the names. They are, however, all people who reside entirely or partly within that silo of people who self-select into this discussion. To sort of close out, I wonder if you could give any examples of things that You mentioned diversity of viewpoints within this roster of contributors, right? Some people who are advocates of returning to some form of conscription, some who are clearly are not. Are there points of agreement that everybody says, hey, this is the thing that we need to focus on, or this is the thing that we need to get right?
Our strongest proponent for returning to the draft was Dennis Leitch, General Dennis Leitch. Mm-hmm. And his reasons were on basis of fairness, efficiency, and sustainability, right? And then, you know, others point to the relative ease with which force has been used, for example. And, you know, we've already talked about what it would take to mobilize sons and daughters. I think where we ended up largely coming to agreement was that, look, the AVF model has been wildly successful, but it hasn't been without cost and an outsized burden increasingly shared by a relatively small cohort that is shoulder to load largely irrespective of additional burden. But that while it is likely to exist absent a broad mobilization exclusively, it requires changes certainly on the margins for it to be sustained. And Carrie Lee did a fantastic job, you know, concluding the book and talking about, hey, look, we've got to ensure that the AVF is on a sustainable fiscal path. It must continue to compete certainly well in the modern labor market, in the future labor markets. And then it must maintain its legitimacy in the eyes of the American public. And that's not just to recruit, but also to build and maintain trust. You know, trust was a variable or a topic that came up multiple times in discussions across our like 30 co-editors and contributing authors. You know, by and large, people recognize that the military continues to be the most trusted institution, arguably, in the United States, above all things. But the question begs, how much trust is too much trust? And then trust is a very brittle variable as well. Because, yeah, I would love the military to continue to be a very trusted institution, but it also must be couched in the context of the fact that we want trust in all of our institutions.
Yeah.
And so I think where we kind of coalesced as a group is that, you know, embracing that those were necessities moving forward.
Keith, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think that, Jaron stated it really well. I mean, the all-volunteer force has been, just a phenomenal thing, but we can't rest on our laurels. We have to continue to nurture it. We have to continue to think about how societal norms have shifted, how labor norms have shifted. And if we don't continually work on sustaining the all-volunteer force model, we'll rapidly find ourselves with a deficit of recruits and increasing inability to meet foreign policy and national interest challenges.
Well, gentlemen, I think we will leave it there. I have a terrible habit of introducing a question as my final question and then coming up with three more. I do have them in my head right now, but I think now that's a very good point to end on. The conversation will surely continue. It should continue. And both of you and your co-editors and all your contributors are to be applauded for doing your part to carry that discussion forward. So thank you both very much for joining me on the MWI podcast.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for having us.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing, if you aren't following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.